a real conversation and some hard truths. Gangs, drugs, and guns. Giving a voice to those willing to sacrifice. We have stories that need to be told. We have lessons that need to be taught. Protect and serve. Welcome to The Quiet Professional.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Nathan Romas with you. Today, we are going to be talking about veteran and first responder mental health. For that, I have Derek Shenko on the program. Derek is the CEO and Chief Mental Health Officer of Diversified Rehabilitation Group. He has over 20 years of experience in the public and private sectors in mental health, disability management, return to work services, and public speaking. Derek is a certified police chaplain and has extensive experience working with veterans and first responders. He holds a master's in military psychology and a bachelor of social work degree. He's also an author and a PTSD survivor himself. So we'll get into all those and much more. So welcome, Derek.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe we can kind of start just getting the guests kind of to know you. And if you could talk a bit about where you're from and how you got into this world of dealing with mental health and helping out law enforcement first responders.
It was definitely an interesting journey for me. As you can sense by my accent, I wasn't born in Canada. I was born in Poland. I came here on the age 26 of my age. That was in 1989. I landed in a beautiful city called Winnipeg, where I spent about 11 years, and a city that actually changed my life forever, what happened to me there. So my first degree is actually in civil engineering, had nothing to do initially with what I'm doing today. When I came to Winnipeg, I didn't speak any English. I came with my wife and a year and a half old daughter, and work in a tubing company making big pipes from steel. And this is where I had my work-related injury. One day on my way home to work, I dropped my child home, told her that I would pick her up from school, and I never did. And I never did in so to say, quotation mark, for another 4.5 years. What happened on that day, I sustained a work-related injury, which left me with severe, not only physical injury, but also with trauma, PTSD, which I didn't know what it was. I didn't even know that you can call it, that you call this PTSD. As a grown man, by the journey of me getting better, trying to get better, initially not being even able to express what was going on for me emotionally and the language-wise, because I didn't speak the English language. So that was quite challenging. But with time, with the right support and good people, I was able to bounce back. But it's been a journey for me for over 4.5 years. But I'm glad that I am where I am today. As a part of the journey, I decided to change my career. And the main reason for that was for me to go and get my engineering diploma. Back then, I would have to go to school and start from all over again. I always was drawn to helping people. That was my passion, aside from my main vocation. So I decided to go and get my social work degree. I got my social work degree as I was recovering from my injury. I was on WCB benefits of Manitoba. And WCB of Manitoba offered me first practicum in the rehabilitation department, and then hired me before I even finished my degree as a first injury worker to work with workers who sustain work-related injury and primarily mental health. So from there, I progressed to another company, Great Was Life, where I had an opportunity to work in different projects, one of them being working with first responders, and as a matter of fact, with RCMP officers suffering from mental health disturbance, whatever that was. And then I spent there about 5 years of my career, and I always wanted to do what I'm doing today. So I progressed to my own journey of opening a business and primarily working with individuals who sustain a work-related injury and on those who've been on long-term disability. As I was working in the area, I realized that there was a huge need to address first responders and veterans trauma. And around 2012, I decided to put a program together for veterans and first responders. Took us about 2 years to design this and put it together. And in 2013, we launched first trauma program that we are currently running, which was way different than it is today, for veterans and first responders. In that year, we had three groups, and that was mainly to really understand if what we put together would be actually suitable for those who came to get better. And we got feedback from them. So we went back to a drawing table twice. And then as of 2014, we have been running those programs on a regular basis. Now, initially, the program was 5 weeks in duration when people would come to us, stay at a hotel and come for a day treatment. But quickly we realized based on feedback from the participants that staying at unknown hotel and then coming for treatment for the duration of 5 weeks was not a good idea.
Okay.
So we turned this into added a residential component, and thanks to feedback from the participants, and that made a big difference. We're so excited that things were working out, people were getting better, and quickly we realized that that was not enough. So they would get better after those 5 weeks with us, but then they will go home and 2 or 3 weeks later, they will crash, they will have a relapse. So we said we must do something, we must come up with something different. And again, feedback on from clinicians and from participants, we decided to add a post-treatment component as a mandatory component of the program. Mm-hmm. And today we have 11-week, that resulted in an 11-week program in total. 5 weeks is a core program, and then 6 weeks it's post-treatment support. And usually that post-treatment support is delivered virtually and consists of one-on-one virtual therapy and group therapy.
Okay.
And that's a big game changer for those who come to get better in the program and then have that support after they leave the program.
I want to go back to just talking a bit about your injury, though. You said that you were limited. I wonder what was that limited both physically and mentally? And just kind of what can you talk about what you experienced in those realms? Just maybe so people kind of get a picture of what is related to their stuff.
Yeah, so my injury was really related to my hand. My hand got crushed by a press, and so obviously that was something that I didn't expect as a 26-year-old fellow. And then the recovery, the challenge for me was that I couldn't communicate my needs because I didn't speak any English. So once I learned how to communicate my needs, it took me a while. But first, understanding my emotional pain, that was something that I was not familiar with. I didn't even know what it meant to go to have PTSD. I didn't know what PTSD was or what do you do with that. So as I think I mentioned, as a grown man, I would wet bed not by choice, but by this being so sleep deprived. Now, trying to figure out how to overcome this, I used some of my logical way of thinking. So when my child was at school, my wife was at work, I would pull all the utensils from the kitchen drawer, and I would start throwing them into a sink to trigger myself, to get myself familiar with what triggers me. And the reason I took those utensils because I realized that when I heard two sheets of metals crashing against each other, I would go into that panic and into that PTSD mode. Yeah.
Okay.
Trying to today, we call this exposure therapy. Yeah. So I was purposely triggering myself. And to give you a more visual way of doing that, I would throw those things into the sink, and then I would run into a corner and crawl as a little child from that trauma that came upon me as a result of that noise, so to say. then I said, well, I have to do something to understand that. So I put the chair between the corner of the of the room and the sink. So I said, okay, next time I'm going to land on the chair and really try to understand my feelings. You know, where is that pain stationed in my body and what does it do to me? So I tried to process this on my regular basis to make that happen. And I was quite successful in this journey and I said, okay, it's time for me to go outside because I would try to avoid going outside, meeting people. So I went outside. I was so happy now that I would be able to handle those weird noises that were out there in the world till I was hit by unexpected and was a smell of burning steel, which was back then I was not aware that that was another triggering point.
Okay, yeah.
So again, back to a square one, and I tried to replicate this in my garage by burning some little things and myself, and the story repeats from the day one. But at the same time, I was learning the language. I was studying, trying to do something. It was very challenging for me because I was loaded with emotions, couldn't really process that. But thanks to actually Works ABC, while I was learning the language, they found a rehab consultant who spoke my language, Polish. Yeah? And actually took the time to meet with me and explain to me what that whole thing was about, meaning what I was experiencing.
Do you think, it seems like you're very self-aware when you're going through that process. Are most people that come in or that come into the programs or I guess just deal with mental health in general, do you find that they're generally self-aware enough to, like, they've gone through steps like you have already, trying to figure out what triggers them? Or do they come in and they're just like, I don't know what's wrong with me, I need some help?
I think there's awareness to a certain level. But one, again, today it's easy for me to say this because I'm part of my job. It's to actually work with people who go through trauma. And so I took the time to learn and understand that. There's definitely each of us has certain level of awareness that things are not right, so to say. Yeah? But really, what we do try to do as a human beings, try to solve it by ourselves. And then not being fully aware what is going on with us for a number of reasons, shame, guilt, lack of awareness what mental health is, stigma, and those other factors that, or really thinking for ourselves, I can handle that. I am able to handle that. This is just another thing, but I think I have this under control, which gets actually out of control.
Yeah.
So each of us has certain level of awareness, but definitely we don't have enough awareness to be able to bounce back. Some people do. Some people do have this within them that they are able to navigate through that journey. But there's a number of people who don't have that, who don't have that awareness. It's very challenging for them to do that.
Well, I wonder too, and I don't know if maybe you know the history of mental health. This is just me asking a general question, but at what point did it become stigmatized to really talk about any of these things or feelings or thoughts, especially for males? I don't know if it's like the equivalent for female members or female veterans. I imagine less so. I think it's probably more of a male cultural thing. But, what kind of created that stigma in the first place where people don't want to talk about this?
I think you need to rewind the clock almost a century and a half ago, yeah, when soldiers were coming back from war. Yeah, in most cases, such a thing like PTSD first was not even in existence. They were not calling this PTSD. And if it was, it was stigmatized by the commanding officers or by the government. So there was no recognition there's something wrong mentally, challenging for those individuals. However, back then, when people were coming from overseas, most of these people would be on the boat, and it was taking about 3 weeks for them to get to final destination, let's say America or Canada, US or Canada. So over that period of 3 weeks, they were with their own people, those who experienced the same trauma, for example. So by kind of not purposely, but by the nature of what how it took to get them to back home, they were able to talk about that. They were able to socialize with others. They were able to grieve. They were able to talk about it. So it was easier for them. But that was definitely not enough therapy for them to overcome that. So when moving on historically, that trauma component was always on the agenda, but the society, doesn't matter whether it was in North America or in Europe, was not prepared to recognize that.
Yeah, they called it shell shock and different things, right?
Shell shock, absolutely, absolutely. And then as we progress forward, even you go back to the 20th century, we became so good at addressing physical conditions and normalizing physical conditions, whether there was a broken leg or whether it was an injury to your head. When you had a physical condition, you know where to go to get help. You will go to a physiotherapist or a surgeon to put you together, and then physio, and then occupational therapy, and off we go. But every time we'll talk about mental health, it was first, nobody knew how to address this. The system at large wasn't ready, because we also need to understand every time we call something, we discover that we need to address, let's say, mental health as a one, then from the policy perspective, from a macro level, government level, that means that sooner or later, we're going to have to start spending money.
Right? Okay, yeah.
And you're spending money, that equals where are we going to get this money from? Yeah. And of course, I don't want to put too much emphasis on politics, but it's also important to understand that politics play quite a bit in the journey of us moving on as a society to get where we are today. And if you really look through the lens not that long ago, in 20th century, we were not recognizing trauma, PTSD, as a compensable occupational condition. So if you were a firefighter or police officer or correctional officer or any first responder individual in the world, you cannot go and submit your claim towards the WCB saying, I have compensable injury, and that compensable injury, it's trauma, PTSD.
I guess to like a physical injury, kind of hard to hide when you're missing a leg or you got a big cut on you. But the mental side, if someone is like, I'm not going to get WCB, all those supports didn't used to be there, right? The social safety net, you would just kind of suck it up and just power through, right? You just keep working because nobody could see what's going on inside.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, there's a cultural factor. Yeah, men don't cry, to say in a quote. So it was a shame to even mention that. Not that long ago, when I was, remember in 20th century, it was almost hard to see the leader of the country showing any emotions. Yeah? Now it's more common to do that. It's a human thing to do this. For leaders to show those emotions. But before it was, suck it up, buttercup. And specifically in the military world and first responder world.
Yeah.
So that was the way of looking at this through the lens. You're going through a difficult situation. Get your shit together, pardon me my language.
Hey, it's all good. You can swear on here. You're talking to first responders and military people.
So and then when we started talking about mental health, and as a Canadians, we should be very proud of this, because Canada is one of the leading country in the world who developed that 13 psychological factors and started bringing mental health to people's attention. That it's okay to talk about it, talking to employers, educating employers, educating the public, educating care providers. And so we started moving the dial forward, trying to normalize mental health. I remember when I ran first mental health first aid course.
Okay.
I had about 60 people in the classroom. And when I started asking them if they are experiencing any mental health imbalance, guess how many people would raise their hand?
None.
Zero.
Yeah.
Zero, none. 2 years later, the same course, about half of the classroom was saying, yeah, me. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's that awareness, just breaking that stigma. But when you talk specifically about first responders and the military personnel, that stigma, it still exists there in our society as well, in civilian world. But in stigma exists, mental health stigma exists in a military and first responder world for a number of reasons.
On that, like, and kind of going down this path, you know, I don't hear about a lot of other industries really talking about mental health. So are law enforcement, military, are they some of the leaders in this, like research and developing programs and kind of seeing it through to the end, trying to get people into recovery or a place where they can manage things?
To a certain extent, you can say yes. I think we are getting more recognition because mental health in the civilian world, I have to say, was a little bit more developed than in the first responders and military. You know? It was there, but we didn't talk about that. We were not addressing it. You know? So now, and that was mainly or still is in certain areas related to the organizational culture.
You know? Okay.
But the organization, how the organization approaches this, and if you would go across the board here in Canada, whether it's the first responders world and the military world, if you go from different sector, not necessarily, let's say, from one police force to the other police force, you will see the differences, no? That one might be more attentive than the other. And so that's the educational component where we are still trying to normalize mental health, that it's okay to talk and reach out for help. But that's on the organizational level. Now, within each organization, you have that executive leadership, then you have middle management, and then boots on the ground. Yeah? So that message has to be consistent. Yeah? It has to start from the top,
yeah.
And the top needs to walk the talk. Yeah? If the top doesn't walk the talk, then you're gonna start seeing some challenges. There's actually one leader in your neck of the woods in Alberta, Lethbridge police chief Shahim. I'm not going to be disclosing his last name, but here's a classic example how leaders should look after their people. And it's so good to see that this change is taking place also from the leadership perspective. Yeah? And there's also that middle management. Yeah? The middle management has the role to play in terms of addressing that, normalizing mental health and empowering people that it's okay to reach out for help.
Yeah.
Now, not releasing individual boots on the ground from the same. Yeah. So we can not only expect from the leaders to do the hard work. Yes, they have to be the one who supports and empower the members to talk about this and create environment for this to take place. Have this authentic leadership approach, empowering people, showing their vulnerability as well. But we cannot release the boots on the ground from the same. No?
Yeah.
As an individual, you have your own responsibility to stand up for your own health, yeah? mental health.
Well, and I think, like, you know, you got a good point where it's like, yeah, it has to come, there has to be some push from the top down, and it has to appear authentic and genuine, right? That they actually care and aren't just saying like, yeah, go do this thing. But I guess like the hard work is going to be for the person experiencing whatever it is they're experiencing, right? Because they're the ones who are going to have to go do the programs and do the work and correct whatever they need to correct.
Yeah, correct. And the other, you ask a question that is first responder world and military world like a leading force in promoting their mental health? I think to a certain extent today is, because it has been so in the dark for so many years. Now we are moving forward, and it's good to see that that we are in the first responders world taking a lead on that. And we still have a lot to do, in terms of breaking that stigma. And sometimes when I keep going to that statement, breaking stigma sounds like a broken record. Mm-hmm. But I think as a society, as a leaders, as a participants, as a those who get injured, we really need to clarify what that stigma is. Yeah? So we need to start naming that. Where is this organizational stigma? If it is, we need to break this down so we have a full understanding, because only then we would be able to address this. And the same applies to individual level. Yeah? If I'm not reaching out, why I'm not reaching out? Mm-hmm. So I understand that it's sometimes very hard for an individual to have that clear mind to understand, because I've been through this myself. If you allowed yourself to really step back, and if you don't feel comfortable sharing this with others, so because of guilt, shame, or lack of vulnerability, do that self-assessment yourself. There's a number of tangible tools that you can go and online even to take that snapshot. Where am I?
Yeah.
What is really happening? And the best option is ask those who are very close to you. And usually it's at the family. Mm-hmm. Say, like, how am I doing? Like, it's like, we already know that if you, let's say, as a new police officer, you join the force, a year from today, you're going to be a different person.
Yeah.
You're going to be a different person because of everything that is taking place in the first responder world. Yeah. You're not dealing with necessarily always nice things there. You're dealing with horrible things. Yeah.
Especially in the last 4 or 5 years, it's been quite the shit show.
Correct. And you're experiencing trauma in 1 week, what sometimes people don't experience through their entire lifespan. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then what do you do with this? Yeah. Like, I think, now we are starting to train our law enforcement individuals what trauma is, how to address that. Well, we are still far from where we need to be. But as a rookie, when you go through the journey of first responders work, you know, or in the military, you deal with things that you are not trained exposed on the spot, saying that this is what's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
And then we train police officers or first responders not to be vulnerable, to be suspicious, to withhold our emotions, because it would be very challenging for us to protect the public and being very vulnerable for that matter. You know? But we don't teach them how to come home and unpack.
Yeah. You know? Or they do it in bad ways, like drinking or substance abuse, right? And they find
that's
other
right.
coping
yeah, that's
mechanisms.
Right.
Right on that point, I was just thinking, like, in some of the material you sent me, where you talk about absorbing the emotions of other people. But then we were saying offline, you also have your own emotions to deal with. And yeah, I think sometimes members don't know what to do with that, mm-hmm. especially when you get the more, I'll say, more sensitive cases when it's like children and animals. I think everybody can pretty much agree those are like the worst things to see, you know, something bad happening to a child or an animal. So you absorb that, maybe not in the moment, you don't realize it because you're doing your stoic look or whatever it is to get through whatever you have to get through, right? Saving lives and working on whatever case you're on. But afterward, you've taken in whatever those people kind of projected toward you, and then you have your own thoughts about it and ways to deal with it. So then you just got all your normal stuff you got to deal with outside of work. So lots of stress, more than the normal person would take on.
Absolutely, absolutely.
One thing I was wondering is, do you see more of external factors being an issue for first responders and veterans from the military, or do you see more on the side of like the internal people having that moral injury, having the issues with chain of command or something happening within that they're like I can't believe they would do this to me. So is there kind of a split between the two?
I think it's and again, to be fair to the situation, it is a split. And whether, I mean, from what percentage and how, I think it would vary from a division to a division, from a city to a city. In my experience, I encounter some detachments where they are very on the top of this, and there are some that are not. You know? So, but to you touch on the component of moral injury, right? From the moral injury, you can experience moral injury in a number of ways. One is by something that is against your moral values, you know, that you struggle with. And the other one could be by the one that is betrayal by the organization. So in any of those aspects, again, it creates quite a deep wound and then a scar. You know?
Yeah.
So, but the challenge with that is how do we address that? Like if you're talking about organizational stressors, so that are caused by the situation within the organization. And, you know, I just came back from a reintegration training in was put together by our CMP. And I don't know if you recall the incident in Delta when there was a young a police officer who there was a hostage taking in a casino.
Okay.
So that was about 2 or 3 years ago, or a little bit more than that. And what happened, that individual, that police officer, they surrounded the suspect. He was the one who shot the suspect. And so after when he came back from that, obviously there's a specific process that they need to follow. But as he was walking into his home office there, you know, police station, none of the management came to actually say, well, sorry, man, what happened to you?
Yeah.
Sorry, man, that happened. Yes, there's an investigation process. Yes, you have to follow certain rules, but it still does not preclude you to be a human and acknowledge individual's pain. And quite interesting, it did not happen because eventually this fellow was charged with the murder. And later on, he was cleared. But for the period of 2 years, there was only two people from the leadership that came and actually acknowledged what he's going through.
This is something that I've dealt with in our own service with members, and just talking about like kind of, I just called it like the circle of closure, where it's like, okay, you had the event, and then people say things in between. But rumors always kind of start spreading and people have their own versions of what happened. But at the very end of it all, so after the fatality inquiry, cleared of any criminal charges, civil suits are done, and maybe general public don't realize police officer has to go through all those different things. At the end of it all, does anyone in the service ever come back to you and say, hey, you did a good job? In the sense like you saved somebody or you protected life, you did what you had to do, what we expect you as a police officer that we hired you to do. It's not saying, hey, we got to celebrate killing somebody, but you know, you're hired to do this very specific thing and you did it and you did it well or whatever they want to say. But that never really gets done. That's always missing.
So if you just, we can just put a pause here for a second. Think of the example that I said for the period of 2 years, what was going on in this individual head.
Yeah.
I understand that IIO needs to do the investigation and they done that. But again, from the leadership perspective, his co-workers were there for him. Yeah? But the leaders, so you question yourself. Yeah, you question yourself whether you did the right thing or not, because you are a human being. So this amount of stress that you go and a lack of support. And again, I took the time to really understand what that investigations are all about and how you go about that. And I have to tell you, I haven't noticed anything that would stop a leader from acknowledging exactly what you said. You've been doing your job. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, whether the investigation must take place, understood, but there's nothing that is stopping a leader from saying, you know what, I'm sorry what you're going through, what you're going through. We are here for you. P. period. Statistically, there's a research done indicating clearly that a word from a leader, an acknowledgement and asking if, for example, an individual, how are you doing, is as important as attending an actual therapy session.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, and there's like evidence, empirical evidence confirming that as the case. So what is still stopping our leaders from making that happen?
Yeah.
What is still stopping leaders from making that happen?
Almost, it would just be a guess, but I would say it's just because they don't understand a lot of it themselves. I'm sure there's some people who just don't care, but they shouldn't be leaders. But yeah, I think there's a big component would be they just don't know. And for some people, maybe it's awkward to talk about a lot of these things because, you know, if you never dealt with it yourself or you're never taking care of your own business, then yeah, you're just like, I don't know the words to relate to that. There is a couple people I've had on the show before, maybe you know them, but they wrote some really good books. So one is Michael Sugru. He wrote Relentless Courage.
I read the book.
Yeah. Yeah. So he has a really good book on a lot of this stuff, talking about the moral injury. Mark Bouchard, so Setting the Sights on Stigma.
As a matter of fact, I'm in the process of reading his book. This is actually a really good book.
Yeah. Well, so his book, well, both of them really, there you go. That's Mark's. So those kind of books from both of them would be excellent reading in recruit training. I know they have the ones from Gil Martin. He's been around forever. He's kind of the godfather for a lot of this stuff. But, if you want some kind of newer perspectives and from people in different places, because the one thing I liked about Sugru's book was it's the U.S., but for us, it's like you can see there's more people out there dealing with the exact same issues. So even though this world's really big, it feels like a small community when you start being able to talk to these other people and relate to them. And then Mark's book is just excellent the way it's written, and it's very relatable. So two really good guys and who've been doing good work on this.
And you're absolutely right. I wrote Mark's book, but this one, I'm in process of, on page halfway. Yeah, so still Mark Bouchard. So we'll see. It's a really good book, And you're right. The more we talk about that, the better we go. More normalizing this is the key to that. Yeah. Now, and you touched on a very important point. Sometimes leaders don't know. And being a leader, and I can speak for myself, it's a very isolated journey. Yeah? You frequently feel very alone. It's not that you're distance yourself, but the position that you are in, because if you're a white shirt, all of a sudden people don't run to you when you were like, boots on the ground. And so doesn't matter what organization you're part of, that's a common thing. Yeah? So that awareness and being as a society, we want to make sure that we create that support for leaders as well, and that support really boils down. Again, from the organizational perspective, we have to stop operating in silos.
Yeah.
Because we operate in silos on the organizational level. Within the organization, you will see a number of silos, and then as a society at large. So I can give you an example. One of the things in our program, when people come to our trauma program, the greatest challenge that our clinicians have, it's to connect with people, clinicians in the community that have been working with clients who are coming to us. And not because of the schedule, because of you name it. But if an individual goes through treatment, it is imperative for us to, of course, with the individual's permission, to share that information with that treatment provider. Because I call this continuation of care. And then it is our responsibility as a organization that runs those programs for mental health programs for first responders to make sure that we educate not only the clinical community, but also organizations, what those programs are all about, yeah? And how do they fit in the big picture. So that's, and again, without breaking any confidentiality, respecting individual first responders' confidentiality, and the same on the organizational level, respecting confidentiality of the organization. But there's an opportunity for us to have a more unified approach when it comes to addressing mental health. From and then again, now another component is being more proactive.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we are so good as a society to call and comment on what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
And entire psychology, traditional psychology, focuses what's wrong with you. And that's perfect because we have the MSA-5 Bible that lists all those disorders, but we focus primarily what's wrong with you so we can help you to bounce back. But we spend very little time on another component teaching in psychology, which is very well established. It's called positive psychology. So in today's world, you frequently would hear words like resilience. Resiliency is really focusing what's right with you. And Dr. Martin Seligman, who is a godfather of resilient positive psychology, speaks very, very widely on what that is and how it's why is that important to us. And like using daily examples, there are a number of things Nate, in your life and in my life that you do to stay well.
Yeah.
So if I would ask you to list, what are the three things that keeps you going? What would they be?
You're talking like working out and, I don't know, doing podcasting so I don't think about work all day.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. So those are the things that keeps you going. That's positive psychology. And just focusing on those things that you mentioned, what does the working out offer you?
Well, you get your physical health, but also obviously the mental break from things.
Correct. Yeah. So it's basically gives you, let's say, that energy boost. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mental health energy boost. Yeah. Burnout energy that you don't need. Bring the positive one. And the podcast.
Yeah. Well, the podcast is just talking to other people and relating with them. I think it's probably the biggest thing. You kind of learn. Like I said, there's other people out there dealing with things, and it's worldwide.
Yeah, so in Dr. Martin Seligman's teaching, he talks about concept of PERMA, positive emotions, positive relationship, relating to doing something in your life that helps you to flourish, mm-hmm. to grow. Yeah. So this is a topic for another podcast. But we need to start putting more emphasis on those components. And we're doing this still in a baby step as a society. We call this resiliency, but there is more that we can do, and actually does not cost a lot of money to make that happen.
Yeah.
But just making people aware and really embracing this as a society, as a community, and as an individual.
Well, you know what? And even talking about how much it might cost, you save a lot of money on the back end when you're proactive on the front end and you take care of things properly up front. One thing I just kind of want to talk a bit about diversified and their programs. So, because I'm kind of curious, like, how do you, you already mentioned you have the 11-week program?
Yeah, the trauma program, traumatic stress recovery program, it's a 11-week duration.
What kind of goes into those programs? So is it a lot of talking, or is there any sort of, are people taking medications while they do this? Like, how does it, or what does it look like?
So this is it's evidence-based and holistic approach program. Yeah? All of our programs are based on that principle. So we are strong believers that when you're going through a challenging situation in your life, and when it comes to trauma, you need to really target this on that evidence-based approaches, yeah? Whether it's cognitive behavior therapy, self-regulation. And so we have, like, obviously, a Bible of those different approaches. But you cannot ignore the holistic approach, that integrative approach to individuals' life. Yeah? Because what happens if you look at mobile above the child's grip, yeah?
Okay.
If you touch one element, what happens to the other?
They all move.
The other moves. Yeah, so that's right. So that's how we approach mental health at Diversified. Yes, we're going to go through the evidence-based treatment modalities, but we also approach this from your home life. Yeah? We also approach this on your from more the holistic. Yes, how do you live your life? Yeah, how do you, like, what other things do you do to help yourself? Yeah, what are things that you don't do? Like, what are the things on the emotional level? How is your family coping with that?
Yeah? Can you do you have the capability? And I guess this kind of goes along the lines of some of your background, but do you incorporate faith into that?
Spirituality, yes.
Yeah,
we do. We know spirituality, faith falls under the umbrella of spirituality. Spirituality means many different things for each of us. Yeah?
Okay.
If it's faith, and we focus on faith, we have therapists who are actually trained in that area, me being one of them. And if it's not faith, if it's something different, then absolutely as well. So we have individuals who address that. So spirituality is actually very helpful when it comes to addressing moral injury.
Yeah.
Just as a side.
No, but you know what? You're on a really good point. One of my previous guests, Matt Domiancic, he talks a lot about spirituality, and I still send messages back and forth with him. I always have questions about this because I think it's a segment of a person that they don't really know much about. They don't explore. And, it's hard for me to even kind of think of questions on it because it's, you know, you can't touch it. It's not tangible. You can't necessarily see it. So I think it's hard for people to grasp, but it's something that definitely comes in when you talk about like your values and your morals and ethics and all that stuff. So it's something that drives you as a human being. I think it's a necessary to address, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, let me give you because sometimes people, when they hear spirituality, they somehow link this with faith, yeah? With religion. Yeah? That might be one way, but not necessarily. I'm going to give you a very tangible example here, and actually I'm able to publicly speak about this. We had once a member, police officer, who came to our program and was in a very, very poor condition. But he asked us if he would be able to bring his guitar.
Okay.
And he said he will have his headphones. So throughout the program, when he was here, you know, he played guitar, he worked. So that became his spirituality component. For him, the music, something that he was able to, that he used to do in his teen years, he brought this back, and it became for him as a very alive coping skills. And as a matter of fact, about close to a year after completing our program, he went public with this, saying, you know, I went to this program, and he was talking about our program, and they helped me to with addressing my mental health, but they also helped me to bring my spirituality to light, which was the music.
Yeah? Okay.
And for him, that became his coping skills. Yeah? It's coping skills that he closely relate himself with, and he calls this as a component of his spirituality.
Yeah, that's very interesting stuff. I'm wondering too, for your programs, or maybe just even if it's not necessarily your program, but if you've seen it be effective, there's lots of talk about psychedelics. Are these, do you have an opinion on these, or do they fit into the programs anywhere?
My opinion on that is as long as we have enough scientific evidence to support that, and as long as we have enough information and qualified people to do that. So I personally am not very experienced in that area, but I know enough to comment. I know people who went through this and it helped them. So if it's approved and scientifically based and it's working, then it has to meet that individual specific needs.
Yeah.
It's not one treatment thinks what is right or wrong. Sometimes as a society, we log ourselves to because this is not approved or not necessarily scientifically based. And I'm going to give you an example of mindfulness in yoga.
Yeah.
I remember when I was like not even that long ago, let's go back to 2013. You were bring components of mindfulness to even the payers, meaning the one who were paying for programs like ours. They would look at this as like, are you God? What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Are you like from God knows where? Yeah. No, well, now today we know there's a lot of evidence supporting that mindfulness can regulate your brain. Yeah? And it's okay. And it's actually very appropriate to have that. This is actually very helpful. It's quite interesting to see when people come to our program and they see that there's going to be a mindfulness component, and especially, again, first responders and military personnel. It's like, what the hell? I'm not doing that. And then seeing them at the end of the program, almost treating this as their spirituality piece and religiously attending those sessions, because what happens, they regulate their brain, yes? Stimulating your emotions, keeping them in a green zone or green and orange. You know?
Well, sounds like there's a lot of different solutions and a lot of different ways we could look at this. I'm glad there's smarter people than me out there working on this, like you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that they're smarter than I am as well. So they help others too.
You know what? I think the amount of talk around all these topics has been really good. You see it on an upward trajectory. And as long as it kind of keeps going in that direction, I think we're kind of in good hands. And there's so many questions about all the different programs and the methods that are used. Maybe just as we're coming to the end of our time, I did want to ask, have you ever seen method that's used or programs or whatever it might be, specific tools, anything that doesn't work, anything you've tried at your program or you've seen others do that you're like, yeah, that's not good?
I don't mind sharing that. So. But I do want to say that it's going to be my personal bias without them. So I just want to make sure that people are aware of that. So I really think that you can tackle one thing at a time. So what I mean by this, if you're dealing with addiction and you have trauma, you address your addiction before you address your trauma.
Okay.
Because it's going to be pulling you in a different direction. Yeah? So my philosophy is addressing one thing at a time. Yeah? So if you try to address everything at once, you may not be very effective in making that happen. But again, this is in my personal opinion. Our program is purely a trauma program. We will deal with mild, moderate addiction, but you need to be stable enough to effectively participate in the program. And it shows that it works. You know? Now, the other thing I think is very important to remember, when you're treating first responders and military, you need to have a separate cohort for them. You cannot mix them with general population. For a number of reasons, I don't think I have to elaborate on them. One of being, you don't want to be in a room with a person that you just give a speeding ticket to them,
yeah.
or that really doesn't understand your trauma. Yeah?
I would think the black humor comes into it too.
Oh, so huge. Yeah, and the same with clinicians. Yeah, one of the things that won't work is not having the right clinician who understands the first responders, the military culture, and the family dynamics that both of those groups, families go through. That's another one. We didn't touch on this. Because if you don't have a clinician who fully understand that, and especially that a sense of humor that first responders and military have, and the values of the culture and what their jobs are about. So that's one of the things that I would caution people to really do their research, to make sure that the clinicians that they are going to get help from really understand their needs, yeah, and their culture, that they, the environment that they are working in. Because as we know, whether it's a military or first responder, it's not just their job, it's their identity.
Yeah. Wow. You know, you hit on so many good points there. I have to get you in touch with Matt Domiancic and even Shauna Springer. I mean, they're the two kind of that I've ever gone to, and they're the ones who like get that. They get the institutions and the people, and in this realm, in the law enforcement, the military, and can speak that language a lot. There are some very good people to talk to if you haven't already talked to them. We're just coming up to the end of the time. I want to make sure you get to tell us about any current projects or any upcoming stuff with Diversified. So what's kind of on the horizon?
Upcoming one, June the 12th and to June the 14th, we have our annual, we call this open house, it's, which offers people to come and see what we are all about. And also we educate, we have an educational component for community providers to really get a sense of what first responders world is and how we do things and raise their awareness. We just put together a program for family members, more just that you're understanding how to take care of yourself as a family, as a spouse who is in a relationship with our first responder or military.
That's good because, you know, that gets missed a lot. And a lot of people don't talk about the family aspect because they bear the brunt of a lot of things too.
Huge. So, on May the 28th, I will be in Winnipeg presenting to families on that topic, just raising awareness. And it's not what's on the agenda for Diversified. One of the things on the agenda is there's help. Whether you come and pick us, choose us, thank you for doing that. But the bottom line is there's so much help there. Go and get help. And I know if you're a first responder, if you're a military personnel, if anything that I want you to get from this podcast, there's help. If you don't know where to go, reach out to us. We'll direct you. We are not the only one that helps individuals like yourself. There's help. The sooner you do that, the better off you're going to be. I know how challenging that is. Safety, trust, all of that. We get you. We have your back. And again, as I said, it's not only about Diversify being there for you. There are tons of other resources. If we can offer you that helping hand, we are here for you. And don't wait. Don't wait. The longer you wait, the harder it's going to get. Yeah.
Where can people find you and your work? I know I've connected with you on LinkedIn. Where else can people find you?
So LinkedIn, Derek Shienko, D-R-E-K, S-I-E-N-K-O, or simply go to ptsdrecovery.ca, ptsdrecovery.ca, and you will find tons of resources. And again, if you need help, we are not in your community, I can assure you that we know who might be available in your community to search for help. So reach out, we'll direct you to what's best for you, for simple reason, because we care.
Excellent.
Because we care.
I'll get all the links up and the links to social media. And people can take you up on your offer to reach out to this Diversified Rehabilitation Group. And it's not a one size fits all. If they can't make it work for you, they can find you appropriate resources somewhere else. So I want to say thank you for coming on, and it was a pleasure.
I want to say thank you very much for having me on your podcast. It means a lot, and thank you for everything what you are doing to help first responders to stay well.
Remind people to share this. Spread the message, like and follow. Some more people we can help, the better. Doing a small part, but I guess as together, we're making bigger changes. So that's it for today. Thank you.